If you heard All Things Considered on Tuesday, you may have caught Dan Charles's report on the high number of deaths among bees reported in American honeybee colonies in recent years. About a third of honeybees don't make it through the winter. That's bad for the bees, also bad for the plants that depend on pollination by bees, and bad for us when those plants are our crops. One of the experts featured in Dan's report was University of Illinois entomologist May Barenbaum, and May is one of our guests today on Focus. She's been doing research on the causes of what is sometimes called colony collapse disorder, and she says a bee's diet may be part of the mystery. Also joining us on the show today, beekeepers. Master beekeeper David Burns, for one, he produces queen bees and says demand for them is up. I'm Jim Meadows. Join the conversation on bees on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we were just talking before we went on the air here with my guests about movies devoted to killer bees and the threat that they might cause us. But we're not talking about killer bees. We are talking this morning about something that seems to be killing the bees. And my guest today, Professor May Barenbaum, frequent guest on Focus. She heads the entomology department at the University of Illinois, maybe best known around town for running the annual Insect Fear Film Festival on campus, which has devoted festivals to movies about killer bees. But May also does serious research as well. That's why they hired her, including research into the cause of what is sometimes called colony collapse disorder, the dying off of entire bee colonies. It's become a big enough problem around the world that some farmers fear for the plants they grow that rely on bees for pollinization. And it's pretty scary if you're a beekeeper, too. May Barenbaum is one of our guests today on Focus, and welcome back to Focus.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we've got a beekeeper with us, too. David Burns is a master beekeeper. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I guess you have to know something about beekeeping to get up to the master level.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
You keep bees mostly for raising queen bees, I understand.
Yeah, that's correct.
And you do a little honey production as well. And you have a farm out near, is it Fairmont?
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
And I believe we have, if you go to will-illinois.edu/focus, you'll find a link to your website for your business. And I wanted to start with you, May. As we look at this problem, can you tell me about the scope of colony collapse disorder here in the U.S.? You were featured on an NPR report, a report yesterday, Tuesday, on All Things Considered that raised some questions in my mind. For instance, Dan Charles reported a winter die-off in the bee population of about one-third a year ever since the USDA started keeping track a few years ago. Do we know if that's abnormally high or just what happens to bees in the winter?
Well, maybe I can set the historical context here, which really goes back to 2006. And that's when the first reports of unusual losses were coming out of Florida and Pennsylvania. And the nature of these unusual losses were a little unsettling for beekeepers in that often there's bee kill with piles of dead bees. They're often the result of pesticides or other clearly identifiable factors. But in this instance, the most experienced bees, the foragers, the ones that leave the colony and bring back resources like pollen and nectar, were simply disappearing, were vanishing. It was very and enormous numbers, great proportions, leaving behind the queen brood or their larvae, their offspring, and as well as food resources. And that's so unbee-like that it was many longtime beekeepers felt it was unprecedented. So that was the beginning. It was eventually this phenomenon was called colony collapse disorder. By February 2007, this had been reported in over 20 states. And February is key because there's about a two-week period in February when half of America's about 2.5 million colonies of bees get shipped to California to pollinate almonds. At the time was about 600,000 acres of almonds. And there was a worry that there would not be enough bees. We have so few options for managed pollination services beyond Apis mellifera that it really was a cause for national concern. There were hearings. There was, for the first time, I think, in recent memory, bipartisan action on the part of Congress to support research to find out what was happening with the bees, to support pollination studies, because what was lacking and was pointed out in a 2006 study that I chaired for the National Academy of Sciences, we don't really have very good numbers. So we don't know what the losses were. We don't have a historical baseline. We have anecdotal evidence. So these losses were the impetus for the Apiary Inspectors of America and other interested groups to start annual surveys trying to figure out the percent loss and then the causes of those percentage losses. And since that time, in fact, losses have been around 30%, with the notable exception of 2011-2012, where it dropped for reasons nobody understands to 21.9%. So in a sense, over the span of the last 6 years, 31% losses aren't unprecedented. How they relate to pre-2006, nobody really knows, except based on anecdotal recollection. Frankly, I thought they'd be a lot worse, but that's where we are today. And it's your question's hard to answer because without a baseline, nobody prepares ahead of time for the catastrophe they don't know is coming. So we don't have the baseline.
Well, just a clarification here. When we're talking about the colony collapse disorder, we're talking about bees that beekeepers keep for honey production, to be available for pollinization, for producing queens for other beekeepers to buy. We're not talking about bees that simply exist in nature.
Well, that's worth just explaining too, because the honeybee, the western honeybee, Apis mellifera, is not native to North America. All the Apis mellifera, all the honeybees we have here, are the descendants of bees that were brought from somewhere else. The genus Apis actually evolved in Africa and Asia. That's where all the other Apis species are. So they're not really a natural part of our landscape, but they've been here since the 1600s. And for centuries, we had reliable populations of so-called feral bees, bees that escaped from management and established themselves in dead trees and other natural cavities. And in the mid-1980s, there was an accidental introduction of a blood-sucking parasitic mite called Varroa that was that arrived here and caused massive losses among the feral bees. So nobody was monitoring those either. We know that there are far fewer than there have been, at least in the general landscape. There are few studies, not many, of feral populations. But the general consensus, and we can ask official beekeepers, is that bees that are not actively managed for varroa control don't face a very rosy future.
Well, David, let's bring this to you and your work. You keep bees out near Fairmont. But how many bees are hives, or how do you count bees?
Well, it's hard for us because we're constantly dividing up our colonies. We also produce nooks and sell those to customers.
A nook is?
It's 4 or 5 frames out of a real healthy colony that someone will buy those 4 or 5 frames with a queen in it, brood, pollen, honey. And that's how they get their start. And we produce queens, so I'm always making mating nooks that takes a lot of bees out of my hives. So it takes a lot of bees to make queens.
Okay, so it's hard to say how many colonies or how many bees.
Oh yeah.
If someone asks, you have to put it down for an insurance form. What sort of thing?
I just say lots of lots. It changes, because I can go out there one day and I can turn a few into a lot, or I can turn a lot into a few. If it's coming close to winter, I may have to regroup them, put them together. So honestly, I just don't keep count of those numbers.
Okay, how long have you been in the business?
I started beekeeping in the early 90s, and I've been running our beekeeping business now. It's a hobby that kind of went wild since about 6 or 7 years now. We manufacture all the beekeeping equipment, so we're kind of hopping.
Have you noticed any change in bee population yourself at your farm?
Not in my farm. I got into beekeeping just prior to the mites really getting bad. And so I did notice that difference in how hard it is to keep bees now. It's a different breed of beekeepers. You just have to be an educated beekeeper to make it work today. Because of the varroa mite.
The varroa mite, and that's something that you mentioned. What was the name of that mite again?
Well, it's called the Varroa destructor. It's a parasitic mite. It's related to, you know, our mites and ticks, but it's an arthropod like the honeybee is. So if you look at a mite on a honeybee, it's not like a tick on a human. It would be like a lobster on a human. I mean, they have an enormous impact because of the relative size. Also, their biology. They like to attack bees in the pupal stage. And the pupal bee, that's the intermediate stage between the larva, the grub, and the adult. And during that stage, all the tissues are being reorganized and restructured to make an adult. So the bee is kind of helpless. It can't groom itself. It can't protect itself. So these mites have found the Achilles heel or the Achilles tarsal segment or whatever you'd say for an insect, attacking its host when it's most vulnerable and sealed, so the workers, other workers, can't even pry these things off. So the numbers build up. They're kind of hidden. It's hard to see them. And they are insidious. They are also carriers or vectors of many, many bee viruses. And we've seen, particularly with the advent of the honeybee genome sequence, the sequencing of the honeybee genomes, which was based here, actually, a proliferation of these viruses. So bees are subject to a mind-boggling diversity of viruses, which weaken them and cause problems.
So it's not the mite itself, although the mite would be a problem, but the diseases that the mite might be carrying to the bee. And this is something that you have to deal with.
Well, you know, when a mite does attack, parasitize a bee, it does shorten the bee's life probably by half. So the colony is in trouble because the bees are damaged. They have a wound, an open wound that they're going to suffer with. And let me say this, though, Jim. I don't want to paint just a terrible picture because beekeeping is great. I mean, I'm passionate about honeybees. We need them. And I mean, my wife and I are encouraging more people to keep bees. And we are able to manage these challenges. But it just takes a lot more work. And this knowledge of this varroa mite that, like, we're having this discussion now, there's a lot of beekeepers that won't study this and they won't learn how to either naturally combat it or use some type of chemical in the hive to help combat it. And they're just prone to all the problems that the mite can create. But it can be managed pretty successfully.
And here, let me get on my soapbox here. In the early 1990s, two pesticides were approved for controlling varroa mite. Now, this is a real problem for toxicologists to design a poison that will kill a mite but not kill a bee. Most of our insecticides kill insects and spare vertebrates, but insects and mites are pretty closely related and very similar physiologically. To find a toxic substance that is, you know, that spares one kind of arthropod and kills another, that's a challenge. And in fact, most of the miticides, the pesticides used against the mite, are only slightly less toxic to bees. So the problem that beekeepers have faced with these pesticides is that the mite evolves very quickly. And the two pesticides that were historically approved, one called Cumafos, one called Tauflavalinate, are no longer effective on most mites because of resistance. They've evolved resistance.
Well, that raises a question. David, what tools do you have at your disposal now? What are you using to combat this mite?
Well, you know, we saw that these chemicals that we began using right off the bat, they did have a negative effect on the rest of the colony. That it was absorbed into the comb. It gave issues to queens and drones, reproductive gland. We just found that it wasn't the healthiest thing to do. But at the time, we just wanted to throw everything we could at it. Now we're moving, most of us, a lot of us are moving toward more natural treatments. I teach my students four levels of controlling the mite. And that is we have what we call a green drone comb. And it's more or less trapping this mite in a drone cell because the drones are in their cell 24 days. And the foundress mite can lay more eggs during that time. And then we also recommend a screen bottom board. A lot of the mites can fall out and not get back into the hive. We recommend powdered sugar treatments, basically just pouring powdered sugar between the frames and letting that maybe cause the mites to lose their grip and fall through. And then also,
powdered sugar does that?
It does.
Because do they go after the powdered sugar?
One suggestion is that sugar is a phagostimulant, incredibly stimulatory for bees, and it may increase grooming, which may lead to dislodging of the mites. Yeah. And then once they're off, they can't get their way back.
Yep. So. And the fourth thing we use is we recommend breaking the queen's brood cycle, taking the queen and actually caging her for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and putting her back in the hive, because the viral mite can only reproduce on the brood of the honeybee in that sealed pupa cell. So if you have enough bees, and once you get your foragers, the numbers up where you want them, break that brood cycle of the honeybee and you break the brood cycle of the viral mite.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we are talking about bee colony collapse disorder, what it means for us. My guests are University of Illinois entomology professor May Barenbaum and Central Illinois beekeeper, master beekeeper, David Burns. And I believe we have a caller waiting for us at this moment. I'm going to go over to line one, Paul in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi. I've just developed about four different topics, but just going back to the coverage this week, Professor, you said that you seem to imply that, or I guess the reporting implied that colony collapse is less common now, and that you were emphasizing, or the little soundbite they played of you was emphasizing that it may be more of a problem of the proper forage for existing. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, we have a small-scale apiarist, I guess they are, and but how much of the statistics about colony collapse and is the industrial, where they ship, you know, bees around in portable hives, feeding them sugar water on transit, and, you know, being a great vector for these mites too?
Well, the first thing to say is that one problem with attributing bee death to colony collapse disorder is we do not have an unambiguous molecular diagnostic for this syndrome. It's a collection of symptoms, and it's generally diagnosed by the beekeeper, and it relates to the relative number of the different categories of bees and the number of frames that are not typical. So there's no real way to know without any certainty whether what is killing bees here is the same as what's killing bees in Europe. What's killing bees here is the same as what killed bees in 2007. So in a way, it's not particularly productive to talk about colony collapse disorder, because whatever it is, even if it goes away, bees still have problems.
And it's not just one thing.
It's
the other question I had was about nicotine and the fact that the
neonicotinoid.
Europeans think that
the neonicotinoids.
I don't know whether we used to grow seed corn around here without dusting it. So I'm wondering, it is possible it might add to some cost, but they're legislating, and it seems to be changing. But I just, as far as statistics, is there any way that you can get this lore from beekeepers and do a statistical analysis of it? I'll hang up in a moment and let you have it all. But
there have been studies. This is the Apiary Inspectors of America have been doing this survey. And again, you have that uncertainty about self-diagnosis of CCD. But at least in 1 year, I believe it was 2010, 2011, the proportion of bees lost in the large commercial operations was not statistically higher than in the sideliners and hobbyists. So it's not there. This mass migration of bees to the almond, which are now, I think there's now 800,000 acres of almonds. Bees come from all across the country. They interact in a relatively defined area, and they bring with them. It's just like, here's a bad analogy, but every fall at the University of Illinois, students come from all over the place, and everybody gets sick for a couple
of
weeks. So it's clearly an opportunity for mites to spread, for diseases to spread, for nutritional stresses to be particularly acute, because there's this 2 week period, and if the bees all assemble there, if the almonds aren't flowering, they don't have anything to eat. If the almonds are flowering, that's all they have to eat. neither is particularly compatible with the evolutionary history of the honeybee, which is by nature a gleaner and is accustomed to feeding on a broad diversity of floral species and floral nectars. And it's not really clear, and that's what some of the research that's been inspired by colony collapse disorder, to find out how important it is for bees to have a varied diet. And there is evidence. Some of our alumni, in fact, have done studies showing that combinations of pollen are much more health-promoting than single species of pollen for bees. And some pollens are simply not suitable for bees at all. This is maybe something David can address. Corn pollen, for example. Corn is a wind-pollinated plant. It is not an insect-pollinated plant. The corn pollen is not optimally configured to promote the survival of pollinators, and it doesn't. So I don't know if David would like to comment on corn.
I just don't see bees on corn.
That raises a question. Thank you for your call, Paul. Which crops here in Illinois, corn is apparently not one of them, really depend on pollinators? Do soybeans depend on pollinators?
Soybeans are able to self-pollinate, so they don't absolutely need honeybees. But there are studies, including one done here at the University of Illinois many years ago, that show that soybeans that are visited by honeybees actually set more pods, and pods are fill better because the bees actually promote pollination more than self-pollination.
So it's not absolutely a survival a requirement, but they sure are nice to have.
Most of the fruit crops, and I should turn this over to the real beekeeper here because I know very little practical information. Just what I read in the scientific literature and what we've done in the lab. But fruits and vegetables. So Illinois make,
pumpkins,
apples, peaches, pears, cherries.
There's a bit of a wine industry, so grapes here in Illinois.
Grapes are another case where they are not.
Grapes don't need the pollinators.
Grapes and olives don't need.
Okay, but fruit trees and pumpkins, maybe other melons that are
all the melons
grown around here. These are the sort of things that really depend on pollination, and so honeybees are good to have around.
Absolutely, it's unbelievable what it's going to do if we lose that kind of level of pollination on our crops and vegetables. You'll have underdeveloped or poorly developed, cucumbers. They have to be pollinated.
Has this sort of colony collapse disorder shown up in Illinois yet?
We've had, I just talked to Steve Char, the director of the inspectors here in Illinois this morning, to get that information. There's been one case in northwestern Illinois that was confirmed by an inspector.
And that's when we're talking about colony collapse disorder, which means essentially an entire colony, maybe a hive, has just totally died off.
Not totally died off. I think May should speak to this, but the characteristics of the symptoms are so unique that they kind of have to fit these symptoms. You know, you have the queen there. You have, I think, not many young bees, maybe some adult bees there. It's just gone. It's disappeared. And what's funny is, too, other pests, like you would think the wax moth, small hive beetle, they're not getting in there and doing their job on it either after a colony gets weak. So it has some key characteristics, but it is hard. I think it'd be really tough to look at one and say, was this from something else? How do you eliminate? Was it mites? Was it? Did they kind of break up from other causes?
Let's take another call. Let me go to line 4, a caller from Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning to you all. Ms. Barabom and I have talked about this more than once. I grow one of the crops that do use bees. I grow a heritage-type peach that I enjoy. Mm. And these white man flies, as they were called by the pre-Columbian people of America, don't do their job now, like you say. And as you were pointing out there, the feral mite, the mites that cause problems with this, you can't poison them without poisoning the bee. But how about trying a situation where you find something that may be parasitic to the mite, or a virus or something that kills the mite and not the bee? Is there possibilities in that aspect?
There have been all kinds of research efforts launched to find an environmentally sustainable way to manage varroa mites. That's probably the number one priority among beekeepers, even if the public is has broader concerns about other issues. David mentioned some of the alternatives. There are some least toxic pesticides, formic acid, thymol. These are naturally occurring substances that apparently are less likely to cause these problems with bees. There are efforts to breed what are called more hygienic bees, bees that are less tolerant of mites on their bodies, and therefore
and grooming.
They groom more
and the
vigorously.
The grooming, yep.
There are some beekeepers who've found that providing foundation or this wax base for bees to build their cells with smaller cells also may help manage varroa mites because there's less room for the populations of varroa to build up. So there are all kinds of ongoing efforts, but it's a really tough challenge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be back with more about bees and the problems they're facing right after this break. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Master Beekeeper David Burns and University of Illinois entomologist May Barenbaum. And we're talking about a colony collapse disorder, which has threatened bees in many parts of the world, including the U.S. Not so much in Illinois, but we don't know how things will change in that area in the future. You can join the discussion by calling 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We are on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Our phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. And May, I wanted to ask you, you had been leading some particular research into this question yourself, and what in particular was your team looking at?
Well, I have a longstanding interest in how insects eat plants. For a long time, worked on caterpillars that eat plants, but bees are actually insects that eat plants because they eat pollen and nectar, and those are two plant tissues. They're different from the tissues that caterpillars eat, like leaves, and that leaves tend to have many different insecticidal compounds because plants can't run away from their enemies and rather use this chemical warfare to fend off their enemies. And in contrast, because plants need pollinator partners to carry their pollen grains and bring about the process of pollination and fertilization, they provide rewards for pollinators. So it's a different kind of chemistry. So when the honeybee genome was successfully sequenced, one of the big surprises in the genome project was just how few detoxification genes honeybees have compared to other insect genomes. So that was very intriguing to me because
by not having detoxification genes, it means they're unable to.
Well, we don't know that. That was the issue. It was an observation. They have about one third to one half the number of other insects. So it could be they have fewer genes that take on more chemicals, or it could be that they can't handle more chemicals. That was what got me very interested in how honeybees handle natural and synthetic chemicals. So that we tried to, there are 46 genes that in a family called the cytochrome P450s, not a very user-friendly name, but that's what the biochemists called them, that in all other aerobic organisms are involved in breaking down toxins, including us. If you drank coffee this morning, your cytochrome P450s in your liver are breaking down the caffeine. So honeybees encounter lots of natural phytochemicals in the nectars, and they concentrate them, from many different flowers. So we were interested in how they do that, and we're also interested in how they process these evolutionarily new chemicals, the synthetic organic insecticides and pesticides in general they have not encountered until post-1939. So this recent paper the study we just published, we were interested in how bees recognize food and turn on their detoxification enzymes because they have no predictable food components for the most part. Every frame, David will attest, every frame of honey is different because different nectars go in Because bees are active all spring, summer, fall. They bring in different nectars, mix them up, store them, eat them later. So how do they know that food is coming in? How do they know that toxins are coming in? And we noticed that honey actually turns on some of the genes that are involved in metabolizing toxins. We wanted to find out what specific chemicals in honey are the cues for bees. So my postdoc, Wenfu Mao, basically disassembled honey. Honey is very complex, very unpredictable depending on the nectars. So he took it apart into its component pieces and tried to see which chemicals turn on these genes. And he found four, one of which was incredibly good at this. And we were amazed and delighted to find out it's a chemical called p-cumaric acid. Why is that amazing and delightful? P-cumaric acid is not particularly common in nectar, but it is an essential building block of the cell walls of pollen grains. So it is in essentially every meal that bees eat except for royal jelly. So it's a very predictable part of the diet that comes from pollen. It's found in nectar. And when we took this chemical, p-cumaric acid, and basically using a technique called RNA-seq, looked in the genome to see which genes are turned on by p-cumaric acid. We found every class of detoxification genes. There are three different classes. They were all turned on by p-cumaric acid. Very little else was, but we were very surprised to see that the immune genes were turned on too. So bees apparently have a need in their diet to turn on their defense system to have this recognizable food component.
They need this pollen to do it.
Well, they need at least this component of pollen as a signal to turn on their detoxification and immunity genes.
Well, this question comes up because as we were talking a little bit earlier off air, David, if you're when you're producing honey and maybe you're taking away a little more honey than the bees can spare, a courteous and a beekeeper with some foresight will give something back in return, and it's usually some sort of sugar, a sugar syrup of some sort. I saw it called bee candy. I don't know if that's actually a term people use.
Yeah, it's been called bee candy, candy boards. It can be viewed the way you're describing it. It is I would view it personally as a poor practice to rob all the honey that you can get out of a hive and then try to subsidize that with some sort of sugar or other not-so-natural food for the bees. It's not good for bees. Bees do better. We recommend people, you know, always keep 60 to 70, 80 pounds of their own honey in that hive to overwinter. So that's not a good practice to take all the honey out of a hive and then let them eat on sugar.
The key time is overwinter.
That's correct.
That's basically why bees make honey.
It's to get them through the winter.
Yeah.
They're not eating it when they're outgoing. They're not eating it so much when they're outgoing and getting.
They're eating it, but they're going to have to eat it in the winter because they can't go out and harvest it, during the wintertime.
And that's the question: how much honey can you harvest if you have to leave some for the bees?
Yeah. Well, you know, if your hive made 280 pounds of honey, you could take 200 pounds off and leave 80.
Okay.
But if you take 280 off, then you're going to have to subsidize it. And I don't think that's as healthy for bees at all.
Do you leave your bees bee candy at all, or do you just keep
away? We actually started making a candy board that has several things that we found that be healthy for bees, upper ventilation, insulation at the top. And we also add pollen and some other items to that candy. So they're getting both the carbohydrates, the protein, and vitamins.
Now, is this a candy board for your own use, or is this something that you're selling to other
people? We actually kind of invented it ourselves, and we sell it across the country. And we've had tremendous response from people saying their hives really survived well. Now, let me put a disclaimer out. If a hive has a virus or they're suffering from something that, you know, food can't help, they're not going to make it just because that food's in there.
Does this sound, May, like something that would provide that component? You're saying that the pollen or element of pollen that bees seem to really need?
Well, once again, I'll say this was sort of very basic biology we were interested in. So translating that to practice there are many, many steps in between. And I'm hoping that people don't immediately run out and start dumping p-cumaric acid into their hives because we have not tested this. We don't know the other repercussions. So there's a lot more work to be done for this to be commercialized. But I think that if there is a take-home message, it's they call them honeybees for a reason. They have evolved to eat honey. It's the strategy that keeps them among the very few species of social insects that maintain colonies year-round. So it's, you know, it's kind of been perfected over millions of years, and it's a little hard to mess with it without consequences.
And if you're providing a bee candy, whether or not it has those elements of pollen, in terms of what sort of sugar to use, I was seeing some discussion about whether corn syrup or high fructose corn syrup may not be the best one to use. What do we know?
Well, high fructose corn syrup has been a subject of some
people
considerable
seem to
discussion.
Always pick on
right.
high fructose corn
for a couple
syrup.
Of reasons. One is that it is very cheap, and it is, my impression is, widely used among the big operations because it's cheap, and there are hundreds of thousands, millions of bees that need to be sustained. The problem is that, you know, it contains one type of sugar, but not the complexity of sugars that are typically encountered in nectar. There have been concerns raised that if high fructose corn syrup is made from genetically modified corn, that some of the GM foreign proteins will be present. That has not proved to be the case. Nobody can find these trace materials, or that the neonicotinoids would also contaminate it. Again, that's another. There has been no confirmation, despite efforts to find them, of contamination by neonicotinoids. So it seems to me the problem with high fructose corn syrup is not what it has in it, but what it does not have in it. And those are the phytochemicals that bees rely on for regulating detoxification and immunity.
Well, if you're not using corn syrup, if you're using another type of sugar, cane sugar, sugar beet sugar, would that be different?
Well, David's, what did you call them, candy boards?
Yeah,
have pollen in them, and pollen mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. picomeric acid, and pollen has protein, and pollen has lipids that high fructose corn right. syrup doesn't. High fructose corn syrup is very, I guess, media attractive because of so many concerns in the human population of the sort of mass substitution for other sugars in our particularly fast foods. We're eating a lot more high fructose corn syrup than we used to. So, you know, there is a touch point for concerns about human nutrition. And in fact, one of our graduate students is doing a study on the actual physiological impact of high fructose corn syrup on honeybees. So we'll know if there are parallels in the physiological impact of high fructose corn syrup on carbohydrate and lipid metabolism in bees.
David, I just wanted to make sure I'm clear on the candy boards that you're producing. Is it pollen? Is it pollen? Does that contain pollen plus a sugar?
We actually add it together with the sugar.
So what type of sugar do you use?
It's just regular, probably sugar you buy at the store, either beet or cane.
Not corn syrup.
Oh, no. I've never used corn syrup.
Okay. So I noticed you can actually buy straight corn syrup the store.
Yeah, I was told years ago by beekeepers of long ago how bad that was for bees, and I believed them.
And that was something which is not necessarily scientifically investigated, but just from their practice, they found that corn syrup did not work as well.
Well, it seemed to be. Yeah.
There are studies going back to the late 70s, including some done by one of our alumni, Roy Barker, that examined survival on different sugar substitutes, grape sugar or corn syrup, beet sugar, and the like. And in laboratory settings, bees can, survive. The problem that arises is today is not the late 70s. There's a different chemical milieu that bees experience. There are in-hive miticides. There are more agrochemicals. Mm-hmm. There are other nutritional concerns. So the shift in the apiculture community to these sugar substitutes was at the time justified by data, but the world has changed. So I think it bears re-examining.
Okay, and I don't know if I had gotten clear on what you had found in terms of the chemicals that bees now have to encounter. How well are they dealing with them?
Well, that's one of the aspects of our study. Just because a chemical turns on a gene does not mean that gene product, the enzyme, is working. So we actually tested to see if bees that ingested P. cumaric acid were better able to metabolize pesticides. And in fact, the pesticide we looked at was Cumafos, which is one of the miticides. And in fact, they're 60% better at metabolizing the pesticide if they are fed P. cumaric acid.
Is that something that you think could possibly be applied in the future if you're knowing that bees are encountering these harmful man-made chemicals, that making sure that there is the right ingredient in their diet will essentially turn on the right genes to help them better handle those things?
Well, that's what I was saying. I don't want people to run out and dump P. cumaric acid. So it has to be thoroughly tested. But certainly there's an indication that eating honey may have some benefits with respect to the ability of bees to withstand certain stressors, including pesticides and microbes.
Honey's just a good all-purpose food for bees, it sounds like.
And humans.
Yeah.
That's something to talk about because you're in the honey production business. How do you rate honey? I mean, just as your own understanding of it, as a sugar compared to what else is out there? What give us the advantages?
Well, you
of
know,
honey.
When you think about honey, it's the bees do so much to it. When they gather the nectar, bring it back into the colony, they're adding enzymes to it. They're drying it in their mandibles and carrying it up and storing it. It has so many more compounds to it than just sugar, and it brings about these compounds to us, and I think they're very healthy.
Well, let me tell you about some other work that we did, and it's kind of how I got into bees. In the mid-1990s, in the nutrition literature, there are a number of papers that basically dismissed honey as nothing but sugar water, and I knew phytochemically that was nonsense. So we did a study examining the antioxidant content. So antioxidants are known to promote health and longevity, maybe anti-cancer functions. What we found that the different varietal honeys from different flowers, were 20-fold, varied 20-fold in their antioxidant content. And at the high end, honeys like buckwheat honey have as much antioxidant power as vegetables like broccoli and spinach. So there are antioxidants in honey that no other pure sugars, table sugar doesn't have, corn syrup doesn't have, that are health promoting for humans as well.
It's really amazing. We do have a few minutes left, still time for your questions and comments about bees and colony collapse disorder for U of I entomology professor May Barenbaum and master beekeeper David Burns. Welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We had maybe this is a related question. We had an email that came in with everything considering what bees do when they get threatened or excited. Are there legal liabilities for people who place a colony if they're like in town? I don't know how far out in the country you are, David, but
I'm way out there.
Would there be an issue if you kept a hive in? If within the city limits?
Depends on the city. There are all kinds of different rules. New York City, after almost a century of preventing urban beekeeping, reversed itself, and there are now rooftop bees. In Chicago, there are rooftop bees. And some of the Palmer House Hilton actually has rooftop bees. Washington, D.C., there's an increasing frequency of hobbyist beekeepers in city environments. But every municipality, every area has its own rules about liability.
Yeah, and Jim, I think you'd have to have some good evidence to know that was my bee. There's just natural, you know, feral bees out there. I think, as I understand it, to really hold up in court, you're going to have to really show extreme neglect.
Negligence,
like maybe you took bees and threw them on somebody, but just bees flying around doing their thing. They're out there anyway.
Yeah, unless there's a blanket regulation already in place.
Which some cities do have.
Yeah.
Okay, but if they don't have that, it's hard to sue somebody for keeping bees.
Sure.
Unless you've been tattooing your brand on them or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a whole book, actually, on bees and the law, a whole body of law about honeybees. Hmm.
The mind reels. I'm going to go to line one. Lawrence in Savoy, you're on the air on Focus.
Well, thank you. The rooftop beekeeping in big cities sounds like a good idea to me. I hope it works out to that advantage. I have a couple of physiological questions here. You mentioned all these antioxidants when we swallow them. What happens to them when they get down through the gastrointestinal tract?
Well, there's so many different types that there are many different mechanisms. One well-recognized mechanism of some of the antioxidants is that they may actually turn on the genes that deal with what are called toxic oxyradicals. So oxygen is a wonderful molecule. We can't live without it. But in some of its forms, it actually can be dangerous. So these are superoxide anion, hydroxyl radical, hydrogen peroxide. Some of these, singlet oxygen. These are oxygen molecules that can damage lipids and cause other damage DNA. So the body has a whole suite of enzymes that are aimed at destroying these toxic oxyradicals. So many of the antioxidants activate that defense system, but there are so many different mechanisms of by which we are protected. Some of them are called singlet oxygen quenchers. They actually cause these molecules, which are a chemistry term, excited state, to relax.
Well, I think you've repeated some of the usual suspects for propagation and promotion of those concepts. I'm trying to remain neutral, and I'm not really quite satisfied with what to believe and what not to believe. But I do want to point out to the audience that you really didn't answer my question of what the gastrointestinal tract cells actually do to these things. But let's leave that. But I do want to back up a tiny bit and say that this one gentleman that called in asking you about using viruses or some other kind of agent that would disrupt the life cycle of these mites, I don't think you all answered his question either. Now, I have a specific question of my own that's related in this ballpark, as it were. I'm not sure I heard correctly. Did I hear someone say that if you disrupt the growth stage, or something like that, you use different words, of the bee larva, you also make the mite or whatever it was ineffective? Could you explain that more?
I made that comment that the way that the varroa mite reproduces is actually in the sealed cell of the honeybee cell on the pupa. So if you have enough large colony, you've got your foragers, and you want to pause. And oftentimes this happens naturally. When a colony swarms, it takes them a few days, maybe up to a week, to finally get a laying queen again. And we've found in studies that colonies that swarm have less varroa mites. And we think that's the reason the mite cycle is broken, because the bee's brood cycle is broken as well.
Okay, so then you did not, I understand that, thank you. You did not wish to particularly include the idea that we should try for some kind of chemical intervention with the life cycle of these bees.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I was getting a little worried there that if we found something that might interfere with the reproductive cycle or the life cycle of or the growth development stages of the bees, yes, that would have the effect on the mites, as you were so well describing. But I was concerned that, what other things are going to happen that we don't know about?
Yeah.
No, this is just basically removing them. I mean,
right.
You know, no chemical removal needed. It's just physically manually removing them.
Right.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And maybe a final question here. This is from an email who says that you talked to their cousin at one point about some charities that exist to essentially promote honeybee research.
Oh, I know who that is. Hi.
Yes. If you want to maybe name one or two organizations for people who are interested, where they could go.
Well, there's a wonderful organization, sort of an umbrella organization called Pollinator Partnership, nonprofit. And if you go to their website, which I think is Pollinator Partnership, you can actually specify whether you want to support honeybee health research or pollinator conservation practices or I think survey efforts. So you can actually target your donation for the particular aspect of honeybee help you want to provide. And just beyond money or, you know, funding, I would love to encourage everybody to help diversify the landscape. The more wildflowers, the more bee-friendly resources that you tolerate in your own gardens, the better off our bees will be. So don't look at weeds necessarily as the enemy. They're one man's weed is the honeybee's, you know, wildflower and life support system. So everybody, in that sense, by supporting the diversification of the landscape, can help not just honeybees, but all kinds of pollinators.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I can tell there will be a lot more questions to answer in the future about colony collapse and all the problems that bees face, the ones that we would like to keep around. Our guests today have been University of Illinois Entomology Professor May Barenbaum and Master Beekeeper David Burns. You can find his website for his farm, the Long Lane Honeybee Farm, linked to ours, so you can go to will.illinois.edu/focus or just go directly to honeybeesonline.com. And thank you very much, both of you, for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Thursday on Focus, we talked to Claudia Quigg, who founded Baby Talk in Decatur about a quarter century ago. It's now active in 36 states, providing advice and access to resources for raising children. This is Focus on WILL.